And welcome, everybody, to the Mind Sculptors podcast, where we help you create, or where we sculpt a winning mindset. I'm still workshopping that saying there. Joining me today is, as my guest co-host for this episode, is not Dylan, not Cam, but personally, probably one of the play to win people that I have the most fun hanging out with, enjoy their company, and always have a good time playing Magic with, getting drunk with, going to bars that I thought were going to be much more fun, but were awkward with.
The three great joys of life.
It's my good friend Tyler from Play to Win. Tyler, how are you doing today, buddy?
Hi, I'm so good. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming on. It's a real pleasure. As I said in our intro, you are one of my favorite. You are one of my three favorite Play to Win people.
I will just go whole hog and say you are my favorite sculpty boy. No qualifications.
Well, it's okay, because the sculpty boys are just like, it's really easy, because what you can do then is you can just then, where it gets hard is you have to pick your favorite person from Into the North. Because then it's easy, because then it's, you know, oh, you're my favorite person from Comedian MTG, Ian. Right. And we're just such a conglomerate. Charles, yeah, you're
many
my favorite.
Many creature types on these, yeah, on these folks.
Yeah, we're a mid-range podcast.
Excellent.
So today we are going to be getting into the for real this time. Last time I had Cam on, we titled the video "The Top 10 Most Overrated Commanders in CEDH," and as some of our viewers would know, we kind of rickrolled some folks with that one, and we actually ended up talking about our 10 favorite sitcoms. I'm not doing that this time,
mostly because I don't know any sitcoms, just none.
It is my favorite thing to watch your podcast, the episodes you're on, and watch Dylan and Cam make references, and then you just blankly stare, like, "Yeah, I know. I definitely know what's going on."
No idea what that is.
So we're going to be talking about our who we think the 10 best commanders in the format are right now, best positioned, maybe. Obviously, you can take a lot of different commanders into events and have success with them, which is kind of one of the draws of the format. So this is not a definitive top 10. This is not what I would do with, Ryan, where this is my definitive tier list. Right. But this is my, as of May 27th, the 10 commanders that, at least for me, that I think are probably the most well-positioned, doing the best right now in the format, with, some little bits of information and whatnot. And so starting this off here, Tyler, here at number 10, well, before we get into that, you have a couple of honorable mentions you said before we started, of commanders that you just couldn't take off your list but weren't like the
top 10 to me. Yeah. But I feel like, certainly have a place on the list. I have two of those, though. I also want to caveat first, kind of as you did, that I similarly think pilot skill and pod composition, mm-hmm, always have a lot more to do with the success of a given deck than the cards in the deck.
Yeah.
So I want to get that out of the way and kind of say that's definitely a consideration that you have to keep in mind. So the two that I have here as kind of 11 and 12 that I just couldn't bear not mentioning are Malcolm Tana, mm-hmm, and Rocco. And Rocco, I think, should be in the top 10 for a lot of folks. I think because I play so much Kinnan, I can't completely get out of the mindset of, my experience of these decks. And Rocco is just not a deck that Kinnan is very afraid of. So I think I probably underrate it. And so I'm going to acknowledge that and then do it anyway.
Yeah.
See if you can stop.
I think so. Rocco didn't make my list. It was like I had like a list of 20. that I kind of whittled down, and Rocco is definitely like on my like 11, 12, 13, like in that general area. I think the biggest issue from
the tweens,
if I were to rank the Naya commanders, though, I actually personally, and I think this is more of a playstyle thing, would pick Minsk and Boo before I would pick Rocco. And it's just because of the fact that I know the play lines of get a Rector out, sack the Rector, get the Vivian, do the thing. Like it to me just feels like it's a cleaner deck because it's a creature tutor away instead of needing to chain stuff together. But I also recognize I don't think one's necessarily better than the other. I think they're both about, if you're going to play that type of deck, that's where you want to be. And then it's just kind of like a play style difference. Like Michael Levine really loves Rocco, does not like Skimboo, and I'm kind of the opposite. So I think it's a little bit different. My other honorable mention, and you're going to hate this, but it's actually Kinnan. And it's just
that's
like,
all right.
I like Kinnan a lot. I actually had it much higher on my list originally. And then I started adding more stuff to the list, and I was like, I actually think I like this more than Kinnan. I actually think I like this a little bit more. And then the more I kind of did that, the more I was like, wow, okay, let me rethink this. And so it was, I think Kinnan's probably one of the strongest decks in the format. Definitely think that. I think the biggest issue that it runs into, and I'm sure Kinnan's on your list, but the biggest issue I think it runs into is that it kind of gets hit from both creature and artifact hate angles, which is kind of rough for a deck like that. It does have answers to it, but I think that's its biggest kind of, like, it kind of gets hit by every stacks piece that isn't a rule of law. Like, it gets hit by Grafdigger's Cage, it gets hit by a Cursed Totem, a Stony Silence, any of those things. And
not right, all of those for sure.
Yeah. So that, I think that's what the only reason I would have for keeping it out. And, but I do think that it's very good. And I think that it's probably one of the better positioned decks in the format, but I think it's maybe like 11 or 12, after I reevaluated some stuff, but.
Yeah, I think that's solid rationale. I will say, just because you mentioned the rule of law class of effects, which like Kinnan kind of actively likes to be under, like it's good for us. There's one other class of effects that you see reasonably often that is also worth mentioning, and that's tax effects. So like Thalia's and that kind of thing. Kinnan, if you already have a Kinnan out, you are thrilled to see a Trinisphere or a Tangle Wire or other tempo slowdowns. It does get hit by a lot of relevant stacks pieces. But there also are a lot that are popular that it doesn't get hit by. So I still agree. It certainly suffers from a lot of stacks. But unless it becomes massively more popular, it seems like there's less of that than there is the rule of law effects and the silences and stuff. So there may come a day where those stacks come back, and people are running every null route effect they can or something, and then Kinnan gets a lot worse.
I'm gonna make a really
fight another deck.
My hot take is that everybody should be moving off of rule of laws and replacing them with Grafdigger's Cages and Cursed Totems and null rods and those types of effects. I think that for where the meta is out right now, I think that is significantly better than anything that like rule. I'm not going to get into it. I could do a whole episode about why I think rule of law is an overrated mechanic that does not do as much good as you think it does. So they're only good if you have like multiples of them. And even then, sometimes you just get, Cyclonic Drifted, and you're like, cool, I guess we'll just sit here. But anyway, so our number 10 here, starting us off, Tyler, what is what you put in that 10 slot?
10 slot for me is Kirk.
Okay. Interesting. So what makes you put Kirk in that number 10?
I think Kirk is a deck that is very capable of presenting early wins. And a lot of the pieces tend to be creature pieces. So there's points of interaction, but it's one of those decks where you kind of have to know that there are times that you need to counter the tutors instead of the things they're tutoring for, which can be challenging. And it's pretty consistently able to present a win turn two or sometimes turn three while not being on the very familiar ad nauseum lines that people know how to interact with. So I think that's a lot of upside for it. On the other hand, I don't think it really climbs higher on the list than 10. And even then, it's like kind of a tenuous hold on 10 in my head, because it's not terribly resilient. Like, you really must have Keurig to be doing anything. It's not like you can, you know, sit back if you get shut down and get out some value pieces that are generating your card advantage and keep going. Like, now you really have one game plan, and you just have to try and execute it and hope you don't get stopped every time. And that's kind of the only thing you can do.
One interesting thing with that too is that, like, mono blacks, like, we kind of think of black as like this really good removal like color. And then we were talking about this when we were talking about Omnixilis, where it's like, if you see any enchantment that disrupts you, you're just kind of like, well,
hope I have Feed This Worm.
Yep. Hope I have the literal only card that deals with this.
That's not true. You could run Unstable Obelisk if you felt like being a real freak.
Okay. You got me there. Kirk's an interesting deck. My number 10 is Dargo Thrasios.
Sure.
And that's mostly because of the fact that I actually think Dargo decks are just, like, incredibly well-positioned right now in the format. They take advantage of Dockside in ways that I don't even think ad nauseum decks are really able to do, because of the fact that not only does cracking a treasure, you know, give you one mana, but it also gives you like an additional, what is it, two mana or an additional, I forget exactly how Dargo works.
Yeah, treasures are jeweled lotuses for Dargo, basically.
So it's just one of those cards where, you know, especially once you get one of your outlets for it, of like Life's Legacy or, you know, a Greater Good or something along those lines. Hell, even a Birthing Pod, a Dargo into a Tidespout Tyrant, which is bananas. It just feels like one of those decks that, to me, Teemer, it's just like, it feels very much like, I put this in my notes, feels very much like what happens when you give a Is It Storm player a Seedborn Muse and go, here, figure out what to do with this. And it's a very cool deck. It's also been performing very well recently. So I think, like, right about now, like, Dargo is very well positioned. Rule of Law effects, it kind of plays around those very well, because again, like, green deals with Rule of Laws pretty easily.
And Thrasios, also, I mean,
yeah, Thrasios plays around it. So it's like that, and that's the other thing about it too, right? So it's like, you play a Rule of Law and it's like, cool, I guess I'll just sit here and activate Thrasios with a Seedborn Muse out. Darn. No deck has ever won with that strategy.
Certainly none that I play.
Yeah, none, for sure. it's a lot. And it's also a deck that I think is a lot faster and a lot more consistent than I think people really think it is. People really kind of forget that green has just, like, absurdly good tutors, and green blue also has very good tutors. And especially when your combo is all just built around, I need to get this creature to get this creature, and if not, I'm just going to draw a bunch of cards. Teemer is very well suited for this. So I really like Teemer Dargo for that reason. Is just like at my number 10. I think it's, I don't know that I could put it a whole lot higher than that, but I think it's like just fast enough that it can keep up, and also has enough grind potential that if things get fucky, it can hang around.
Yeah, that's a deck that I'm interested in playing. I really haven't spent time with, but Dylan is currently on that. That's one of the CDH decks he has in paper. So I've gotten to play against it a bunch more lately, and it does seem like a lot of fun to play. But I'm with you that I think, you know, it belongs somewhere around 10. It was certainly somewhere around 10 on my list, but didn't quite make the cut for me.
Yeah.
So Dylan, play it better. Convince me.
Yeah, Dylan, come on, man. Get it together. I think a Dargo deck just deserves to be on the top 10 right now, because I think all of them are just so well positioned. Maybe with the exception of like Dargo Timna, maybe. I don't know that I love that deck as much, but I think like Dargo decks are just like a lot better than I think people really think they are. They are just, they're big, they're fast, and they just kind of hit you like a ton of bricks if you are not paying attention. So
yeah, you don't have to convince me. I played Dargo Jeska for quite a while. I built that myself. Yeah. I mean, years ago at this point, but
yeah,
incredibly fragile, but like, you know, incredibly underrated.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at number 9 on the list here, what do you have ranked as number 9?
Well, I am glad you asked. It is my favorite deck on the list. It is Kinnan, is what I have at number 9.
All right. So, what are your thoughts on Kinnan? Obviously, you like, right? you know, it's definitely not a deck that you have any strong feelings about.
Yeah, for roughly 45 minutes of my thoughts on Kinnan, see the play to win deck tech on Kinnan. But I love this deck. I've been playing it since the day before it was spoiled and have never stopped. And it is the only deck that I like kind of bling out because it's absolutely my baby. I like Kinnan a lot because although there are some stacks that it just can't get through, as you mentioned, it has a lot of relevant interaction. It is in the weird spot where normally you would say it's a deck that has really low card quality because it incentivizes you to run all these big creatures that you don't really want to hard cast, except that your commander generates so much freaking mana that you hard casting a Conqueror's Greater Sphinx is a plan. I mean, that was, you know,
right.
a turn 2 Consecrated Sphinx is, you know,
not how unreasonable.
I won my top 16 in match at Oktoberfest, because you can do that. And some of those value pieces like Consecrated Sphinx and Nezahal and things like that, they're just so backbreakingly powerful that usually if you land them, you're going to be able to convert that into a victory. I also think, and this is sort of underexplored in my opinion, when you have a deck that has a lot of variance like Kinnan, where you really don't know what you're going to hit in that top 5 cards, you can use that as a political tool, because it's pretty easy to articulate when someone clearly is threatening a win, but it's hard to articulate when someone is threatening a possible win or has a difficult to calculate percentage chance of hitting a card that makes them win. And so I think you can often politic your way out of getting interacted with, because you yourself don't know if you're about to win.
Right.
Which is kind of neat.
Well, and that's one of the things I do like about Kinnan a lot, is it has some of that inevitability factor where it's just like, if it hangs around, like we had a guy in our local meta at our CDH meta who plays Kinnan a lot. And for years, I would be the person who would sit there and be like, hey, we need to remove the Kinnan. If you don't remove the Kinnan, like on site, you're just going to lose to it eventually. And nobody would ever listen to me, and they would always remove like the most odd or unimportant things, right? Like getting rid of a Timna when you don't have any other creatures on board or things like that. Mm-hmm. And Kinnan would just kind of run away with it. And it's one of those things where it's like, Kinnan is probably one of those decks where like post turn 3, it does like, it just like its odds of winning continually go up. In my opinion, like the longer it hangs around.
Callahan, stop telling them my secrets. Need people not to know this stuff. Don't tell them how to beat it.
yeah, it's a very good deck. Like I said, I when I originally made my list, it was very high on my list. And then like the more I put my list together, the farther down it fell. But the inevitability factor of that deck is just, it's so hard to not, like to understate how huge that is.
Absolutely. What do you have at number 9?
My number 9 is probably going to surprise some folks, and this might be some recency bias, but it's Tyam Luminous Enigma. And this is a deck that I, for a while, really was kind of like, eh, it's whatever. It's not that, you know, it's not that good. Then I watched, like, I think it was last year Rebel drafted this deck, or it was the year before, in the MLC. And it was like one of the better performing decks in the format. And I was like, oh, well, she must have just done really well with it. And then I started seeing it pop up on, like, in tournament results. And then I was like, oh, okay, whatever. And then Tyvar got printed. And then I really started seeing it pop up in tournament results. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably up there as one of the decks that I think is most helped by the printing of Tyvar Jubilant Brawler. Because that just makes, I think it makes the combo like a turn or two faster.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that I think I really like about it. Also, it's, like I said, it's consistently putting up numbers, even though it's like maybe not the most popular deck. Also kind of benefits greatly from that my opponents don't exactly know what my cards are doing effect.
Yeah, for sure.
Because if you look at a deck list of Tyam, there's cards in here like, I can't even read it. Icacian Money Changer. I know what that does off the top of my head for sure. You know, stuff like that, like, or Croson Restorer, which, you know, obviously some people might know. Skullwinders in this deck. There's a White Plume Adventure. There's even a Knight of the Reliquary in this. Like, it feels very much like a Maverick deck almost. And it's just really cool to see a deck like this performing well. It wins through a weird, like, it is very like, oh shit, if there is a Cursed Totem out, or just kind of like, what do we do?
Doing nothing.
But the lists that I've seen play a lot of things, like, because you're in white, you get to play stuff like, what's the one that Aura Silence, where, you know, just stuff that you're casting anyway and can tutor pretty reasonably well, deal with it. Or, you know, you have some of the new creatures like Lauren that come in and deal with that type of stuff. So Tyam is a deck that I'm with Ian on this. I think it's a deck that more people should be playing, more people should be paying attention to, and definitely should not be sleeping on, because it feels like a deck that really, really preys on people not knowing what it's doing and not really being interacted with. And it's also preying a lot on the fact that there's just no, like, creature art, like creature activated ability hate going on right now. It definitely gets a big boost from that too.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think it's quite strong. There's someone that went my LGS who plays that pretty routinely, and I rarely get to see it pop off. But if I'm honest, and I love this kid, but I think it's because he gets talked into spending all of his interaction too easily. He's very susceptible to politics, and I think he could be doing a lot better, because it's definitely a powerful deck.
Yeah, it's a really cool deck. More powerful decks to look at here. Number 8. What do you have at number 8?
I have Magda at number 8.
Okay.
So it's one that I strongly considered putting higher, but really struggled with.
So give us a little bit of your thoughts on this. What has Magda this high?
So Magda as a 2-mana commander is really easy to recast. It gets to win at instant speed, which is pretty unusual for a monocolor deck. And the printing of Portal to Phyrexia was really, really good for Magda, and allowed it to shut down and slow down an opponent in a way that it really couldn't before. Right. The amount of treasure generation in red is already very high, and is probably going to continue to see more treasure cards printed. And it, you know, with the right hand in any way to make Magda an artifact dwarf, it just becomes extremely difficult to stop. And it's a deck that is capable of going for the win many times in one game, kind of the opposite of Kyrick, where you kind of get one big chance, and then it might take you a while to build up the mana to be able to do that again. Magda, it feels like, you know, if you stop it one time, it has already built up some treasures in the attempt to get to the winning position. And those treasures are just going to fuel getting Magda out again. And here we go again, probably the next turn.
Yeah, Magda is really cool. I remember last year when I feel like we've come full circle on Magda, where when it won Marchesa, it was like everywhere, everybody was playing it, and then people figured out how to deal with it. Then it kind of faded away. Then the really dedicated players kept playing it. Then Portal to Phyrexia came out, and then it started popping off again. I do think the biggest issue I have with Magda is I just want it to run, to not be running Dwarven Grunt or Dwarven Trader. Yeah. Like, there's just like in their defense, they have, it is a lot less of the like just generic do nothing dwarves than it used to be. But like there are so many like shapeshifters out there, right? There's so many dwarfs that have been printed. Like, there has to be two better cards that you can find, right? Like, there has to be some better cards that are out there. There's
there's no way Money Changer is the best card in Thiam either, right? Like, these are card quality issues where you're saying, this is what this deck tells me I have to do, and I'm going to suffer playing these cards because they fit so well with the game plan.
That's fair. I don't know. It's just one card that I do think is really interesting as I'm looking at this list is Flywheel Racer. I think it's a really cool addition because not only does it tap your Magda, but it also just generates mana as opposed to like Smuggler's Copter just drawing you a card. Like, vehicles in this deck are used in a really cool way, which is one of the things I really like about it.
Unless it's Clown Car, in which case I hate it and I don't want to talk about it.
You and me both, friend. You and me both. When I saw that that video of you complaining about Clown Car, I was just like, I have never felt more connected with Tyler in my entire life. I was like, this is how I feel about anything from the Unsets. My number 8 is Rograkh Silas. Sure. I have Rograkh Silas a little bit lower than a lot of other people may have it. First off, like, let's look at the good of this deck. It's possibly the best true turbo deck in the format right now. It's obviously got a really, really, really aggressive game plan that wants to end the game before turn 3. It's just got a lot of redundant pieces that kind of overlap, and so it makes it so that there is a great deal of consistency in getting those win attempts off earlier in the game. But this is one of the things that I do think it is going to suffer from is, you know, Rograkh Silas players tell me this all the time. It's like, well, you know, it can grind. And I'm like, okay, sure, but does it grind like Timnacrom can, right?
Yeah.
No, it can't.
No.
It's not able to grind the same way that these decks that have card advantage in the command zone are able to. And ultimately what Rograkh Silas is doing is it's trading card advantage for speed in the command zone. And like, if you are a Rograkh Silas fan, you have to understand it. Yes, you're able to play Rhystic Study. You're able to play things like this. And I love the Narset Wheels package that is in that. That's a great addition that Bryant Cook made. But that doesn't change the fact that you're still making some deck building concessions in your 99 or 98 because you want to go fast. And that's fine. But that does mean that, like, that you're going to run into some things where you're not going to be able to grind as well as the other decks at the table. And that's, you know, you can grind. That doesn't mean you're doing it well. And as somebody who has played a reasonable amount of Rograkh Silas, and has also played like some other decks that like this is a different type of deck, but let's use Lavinia as an example, because I feel like it suffers very much the same issue and has the same problems just on the stack side of the spectrum. It to me feels like it's the same deck, but on the opposite side of the spectrum. And what I mean by that is the concession that you're making is a very fast and reliable disruption piece in your command zone that is also a block piece at the expense of having any sort of card advantage in your command zone. So what that means is now your deck has to have card advantage engines in it, or a higher density of them, so that you can get back into the game. So when you aggressively mull down so that you can get your turn one Lavinia and this or that or whatever, or if you can get your turn one Necropotence or Jessica's Will or whatever it is you do in Rogue Silas, right? You have to be able to recoup after that. And that's one of the things that both of those decks are going to suffer from, is that, you know, you are making that trade-off. And that's not a bad thing. I still have it as one of the top 10 decks in the format, right? I just think that I have it a little bit lower on the list, maybe not as like 1, 2, or 3, because I just think the concessions that it makes from the command zone perspective just means that, you know, I mean, we've seen this at a lot of tournaments. When you get into these like top 16 and finals matches, they get grindy and fucky. You know what I mean? Like
often, yeah.
They are not very often wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. They are almost always slugfests. And that's one of the things where I look at Rogue Sai and, you know, there's nothing. It is able to, let me pull it up exactly. It does not have any first place finishes with Eminence's EDH top 16 recording system.
It has a few top fours, but
yeah, has a few top fours, but I think that's like a great example, right? Is it's like it can get to the place, and I guess a good example, at least to me, is it's kind of like when you're having a like in college or whatever, in college football, you have like a certain type of quarterback, like a very mobile, fast quarterback, right? Maybe doesn't have the best arm, can make passes when he needs to, but most of your offense is built around the fact that your quarterback is super fast, so you're going to run a lot of like plays that take advantage of that. When you get into the college football playoff, we've seen this with like Oklahoma and stuff like that, where they go up against teams that have good defenses that can stop that. Those teams tend to struggle against more traditional quarterbacks. And that's not a knock on those fast, speedy quarterbacks. It's just this is a limitation that you have. And so the rest of your team or the rest of your deck needs to be built to compensate for that. And so I think it does do that, but it does have that limitation ultimately.
Listener, I want you to know that was for you and not for me. I have no idea what a fucking football is. What is this man saying?
As everybody who listens to the podcast regularly knows, I have to talk about sports at least once. I don't know if I've told you this or not. I used to work in sports broadcasting. I used to cover like, it wasn't the 2016 Cavaliers. It was 2016, but it was the year after they won the finals. So I got to meet like LeBron and Steph and Kyrie and a lot of those players. And so like everything to me is a sports analogy.
Talking about basketball because you said LeBron and I know that one.
Yes.
Did not know what the hell the Cavaliers were. No group.
Cleveland Cavaliers. They're the best.
Gotcha. Team. Okay.
That's my number 8. Like I said, I think Rogue Sai is really good. I don't know that I put it in my top 5. But if you want to go fast, that's probably the best way to go fast.
It definitely is. I think you kind of said it all, but I'm in a similar position. I don't have it quite as high as some people might expect, because it is such a trade-off and such an all-in plan. And my thing with the all-in plans is it requires a skill that I definitely don't have as a pilot, which is you have to be extremely good at picking your moment to go off and knowing when the table has interaction and is likely to be able to stop you. And I don't like playing that game. It's a guessing game that I feel like I lose a lot. So I shy away from those type of decks, but for some people it really works.
Hey, you know, it's fine. And you know, the stuff that Bryant has done, like, I think it is a better deck now than it was a year ago. The like Notion Thief, Narset package that they added into this list was a very needed addition. It does a lot of good. Not only does it like Narset digs for cards, obviously, but you can also use it disruptively. And that is like when I was going through all this stuff and I was looking at these lists, I was like, yeah, that's a good ad. I like that ad. Right. 10 out.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Of 10. Next, we're looking at our number 7. What do you have in the number 7 spot?
I have Tivit in number 7.
Ooh, okay. Tivit, Seller of Secrets. What are your thoughts on Tivit?
This is a deck that I have seen a bunch of lately. My roommate's been playing it a bit lately. It is one of those big mana commanders, and it doesn't exactly win on the spot when you get the big mana commander down the way that I would say, like, Niv-Mizzet kind of does. Like, it feels close to unstoppable as soon as the commander's down, but it has extremely high card quality and does a really good job of being not all in combo, but being combo that also can tempo the rest of the table and slow down the game enough to execute its game plan. And it has access to, you know, a lot of different winning lines that kind of all play well through different stacks. So you have, you know, your normal like Thoracle Consult, but the whole Time Sieve line is, like, first of all, super interesting and cool. I love that card. But yeah. Second of all, the extra turns win is you know, you just need totally different tools to interact with that or stop that. Apart from hard counters, you know, the things that can counter anything. So yeah. I think it's in a neat place. And it's a fun one to play and has high card quality.
Yeah, I put that together to take with me to Minneapolis, and I think I won like at least 60% of my games with it. Like, it Dang. Was just like the deck consistently just is just like it almost feels like, to me, what it does is it sets a loaded gun on the table, and then it's just like, I don't know, you can figure it out. Oh, by the way, my loaded gun has protection, so also figure that out. So it's really interesting to see how it plays. It is on my list, but it's not my number 7. My number 7 is another Grixis deck, and it is Tevish Krom. And Tevish Krom is my pick for best Grixis deck in the format. I think it has a win percentage to back that up. Oh, well, you were talking about this a little bit pre-show. It's got a 30% conversion rating
on, yeah, it's very strong
on, what is it, EDH top 16. And that is the highest of like any deck with more than, I believe the qualifier I put on it was like any deck with more than 25 entries. It had the best results of all of them, including Nigeela, Tivit, Rog'Sai, Bruce, all those decks. Like, it was the best performing of all of them. I do think you are... I am not a fan of the strategy. I will preface this with that. I definitely, it's much closer to my type of game plan if I were to play Grixis. But I think ultimately my issue with it is you have two really, not one expensive commander in the command zone, but you have two expensive commanders in the command zone. And that is kind of hard, in my opinion, but you're in great colors to get your stuff out early or at least reasonably fast. And it's able to match table speed relatively consistently. Like, it can go as fast as it needs to go and it can grind considerably well. You know, I'm not a huge fan of it. I think Tevish is maybe a little bit overblown in its quality. Personally, we kind of had that weird moment where when Commander Legends came out, everybody just kind of ignored it at first because we saw it and we were like, oh, well, nobody's going to play that. And then Rebel started doing a thing with it. And then a bunch of people picked it up. And then I feel like it's kind of calmed back down. And now we have like some dedicated pilots. But
now we say it maybe about as often as we should.
Yeah, exactly. But like, I mean, it's got incredible card quality. It takes an amazing advantage of Malevolent Hermit because not only does Malevolent Hermit at minimum act as a counterspell, it also acts can just draw you a card, which is really good. And then you can disturb it back and then have just protection. It also does the same thing as Rog'Sai with the Thief package, although it is a little bit lighter than the Rog'Sai one. But that makes sense because, you know, you don't need to compensate nearly as much when you have two draw engines in the command zone. And then outside of that, it's just like a pile of Grixis good stuff. It's you can only be so bad with a pile of Grixis good stuff, right? Like,
absolutely. I will say this. I don't actually have this in my top 10. That is partly because, as I said, I did not so much research is just, you know, go anecdotally from my own experiences and putting this together. And that is a deck I've played against surprisingly a few times. I would say, I think less than five times. And I play an awful lot of CEDH. So, you know, maybe some combination of chance or whatever. I'm not really sure. I just feel like I see it very rarely. So maybe I don't know enough to be afraid of it and I should be. But it seems like one of those decks that definitely requires you to mulligan aggressively and to understand your role in the pod before you have an opening hand. Because when your commanders are just, you know, two advantage engines and you need to figure out the game plan with the 99 instead of with the commander, you really need to pick the right game plan right off the bat and keep a hand that matches it.
It definitely plays along a very similar axis as Timnachrom. Like, it definitely has a very similar vibe to it, but it's a little bit more a little bit more turbo-y, which I don't love, but you know, I do think it's probably the best Grixis deck in the format right now, just because I think it's a little bit more, it is more consistent than Rog'Sai, and definitely has the stats to back that up. But
I'll have to check it out some more.
Yeah, it's a really cool deck. On to number six. What do you have in your sixth spot there, Tyler?
I think this is where I have Rog'Sai. Am I counting this right? This is where I have Rog'Sai.
So what are your thoughts on Rog'Sai?
I think you kind of said it all. We covered a lot of it when you were talking. I admire how fast it can go. I think it's surprisingly able to sometimes present, you know, a second or third win attempt when you think it's out of gas. But it is definitely, you know, a Corvette, like it only races for the most part. I don't know. Maybe I should try and think of a sports analogy for you. Like, just completely mess it up.
Well, I think a better analogy might be like a drag car, right?
There you go.
Like,
yeah.
It just like it's not going to twist and curve really well, like your BMW M10 or whatever. But it's like a really nice, like tricked out, like drag, like what are the old like Mustangs that they used to like?
Sure, yeah, old muscle cars. Like
muscle cars. That's the word I was looking for. My brain was just not letting me find that word.
yeah, I have this stuff on the mind. I'm buying a car on Monday, so that's all I can think about. But
yeah, I definitely would agree with you on that. It definitely has some of that. Like, it is big, it's fast, and if you can keep it from outrunning you, you're in good shape. Because once you get past turn three, it doesn't have a lot more to do. I do have in my notes, though, I will say this, not to keep talking about it, but it is what I did say in one of my note points, will continue to pressure wins late in games if allowed to hang around. That is definitely a don't completely ignore it after turn three. So my number six is Sisse Weatherlight Captain. This has been a card I've been very high on for a really long time. I remember before even Ikoria came out, I built a version of this deck that I called Weatherlight Consultation. That was you basically playing a five color Thrasios Timna deck, and then you had a way to tutor out a, you know, Lab Man, or at that point Lab Jace, to the table, and then you do the consultation stuff. Obviously, this deck is not doing that anymore. Not to say that you can't do that, but I mean, Ian just placed second with it over the weekend. This was one of the decks that I told you about when we were at Oktoberfest, because this was one of the decks that I played. I think it was round two, and I just sat there and was like, I don't even care that I'm losing to this, because this is insane. Like, this is so cool what this deck is doing. And none of my there was the only stacks piece I could have had that could have stopped it was Cursed Totem, and they had answers for it anyway. So it was like one of the most surprisingly resilient decks that I have ever seen. And it plays on an axis that is just completely different than what everything else in CDH is doing right now.
I think it's in a really neat spot like that. I also, one thing that tickles me about it is it always feels kind of like Protean Hook decks used to, when we saw a lot more of those, where there's like a sequence of creatures that you kind of really don't want to see in your hand, so it can occasionally be a little awkward. But it's definitely one of the better five color decks. I don't have it on my list, and part of that is just I don't have a lot of experience with it. I've never played it. And really only saw a lot of it when it was, you know, the early version with Juggy from Rebel. I haven't played it that often lately.
I have the unique experience of being able to say that I played Sisse before Rebel did.
Nice.
Because what was it? My Weatherlight Consultation deck on Tapped Out I made that list like maybe right after Modern Horizons came out. Like, I would immediately hopped on that train. I was very into it, but so that is my number six. Looking at number five for you, what is your the back half of this, what is your number five?
Kark Sakashima is my number five.
Okay, so Kark Sakashima is a very good deck. What are your thoughts on it?
I just got whooped by it filming for the last 4 hours, so it's very fresh in my mind.
Oh no.
I think it's one of those commanders that should be kill on sight, but people just don't kill it on sight, or don't use the single target removal on it because it's 2 mana and it feels like it's just getting recast the same way Kinnan is. But it's especially because it's like somewhat non-deterministic. It really depends what the Kark Sakashima player has in hand, like how worried you have to be. But one thing is for sure, it is capable of generating a crazy amount of card advantage with spells. And it is very much a Storm deck in that there's going to be one big turn, and if you don't have enough interaction to really stop it, you just need to like pray that you get lucky and, you know, use the bathroom and come back in half an hour and see if they won. It is terrifying to try and keep track of everything that's going on in that deck when it's really going. It can be difficult to interact with just because if there's at least a Kraken, and especially if there's a Kraken in any of the copies, especially the whatever the Strixhaven guy is, who with Sakashima makes it like four total triggers on everything that they cast. I'm blanking on the name. I think it starts with a T, right?
I know what you're talking about, but my brain is also blanking. Anyhow,
yeah,
I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. This is where editor Caleb pops in.
Sorry, thank you.
Anyhow.
But yeah, I think it is just able to defend its wins really, really well with just one counterspell if it already has the pieces on the table. So anytime that they untap with a Kraken, you're really taking a gamble and hoping that those last few cards in hand aren't going to turn into 80 mana and 10 cards in hand. And it's just nothing other than Kraken is on board to tell you that the win is coming. So it just doesn't telegraph, which is very hard to play around.
The best rule of thumb, and also I think you're talking about Tavern Scoundrel, question mark?
No, there's also a really scary card in the deck, but this guy's one and a blue.
Is it Vayran, Voice of Duality? Vayran.
Yeah, Vayran. You're right, okay. Vayran.
Mm-hmm. So my rule of thumb of playing against Kirk, which by the way, if you've not read Ken Bauman's Primer, read Ken Bauman's Primer, because it will tell you exactly how to beat Kirk Sakashima, which is a fun thing that Ken does. But generally, my rule of thumb, no pun intended, is whenever, if there's a Kraken on the battlefield, that's fine. When the Sakashima is on the stack, that's when I'm dealing with the Kraken generally, because that is your best window as a table to get rid of the Kraken and then also disrupt the game plan of them, because now you're just kind of like, well, you have a 3-1 that gets rid of the legend rule. That's cool. but that's generally my rule of thumb with Kraken Sakashima. But I agree with you. If anybody has ever played Giftstorm in Modern, this is probably the closest approximation to that deck you can get in.
Ironically, that is what I entered Modern playing was Storm Gifts Ungiven, old group shot. Yeah,
I used to play the hell out of that deck. My number five. So this might shock some people. It's a Traxa Grand Unifier.
Whoa.
I keep seeing this deck do really well. And then I played it. And I was like, this is better than Thrasios and Timna, and I don't think it's particularly close. And here is why, at least in today's universe. So, first of all, it's the second best Displacer Kitten deck in the format. I think you could probably intuit what the best Displacer Kitten deck in the format is. But one of the things that it gets to do is it plays basically the same good card pile that Thras Timna plays, but has the advantage of not needing to try and cobble together a win con because the win con's in the command zone. And so what that means is your card quality actually ends up being better than what it would be in Thrasios Timna, because you don't need to set up a Carrion Feeder, and you don't need to set up a way to discard your Hulk or get out your Isochron Scepter or insert way of getting value engine set up. You just need to sit there, grind. Your deck already grinds great because you're in the four best colors to sit there and just draw a card, go. And honestly, like, yes, the commander is expensive, but you have Jeweled Lotus and a bunch of dorks that you're playing out early anyway. So it's not like it's coming down still like at this awful time. Like, it still has great ramp pieces. It has great mana dorks, has great grind potential. Also, It's a 7-7 with Death Touch Lifelink flying vigilance, which is stupid. So it has that like degree of inevitability to it. And so I think like the only downside that I have to it is the versions that I have seen out there are not playing Vivian Champion of the Wilds. And I don't understand why food chain players don't play the card that lets them win at instant speed. It just drives me nuts. It's so easy. But yeah, like I had originally had like Thrasios and Timna on this list, and then I went to go like place Atraxa. And I started kind of looking at lists next to each other, and I was like, I've played both of these decks, and if I was going to build either right now and take it to tournament, I'd be playing Atraxa in a heartbeat, because it's just, in my opinion, I think Thrasios and Timna kind of butt heads against each other. And this is actually a philosophy I've had for a really long time. Thrasios wants you to grind with dorks, right? So it doesn't want your dorks to be swinging in for attacks. Mm-hmm. That's what Timna loves about the dorks, right? The issue I see is that it kind of has two conflicting advantage engines in the command zone. And so it kind of makes it so that you aren't getting the best out of either of them, in my opinion. So to me, now, with that being said, I think back in the day when like Flash Hulk was the thing, right? They were unequivocally the best commanders to be out at the same time or to have in your command zone because of everything that they did for your Flash Hulk game plan. That being said, I don't know that I like them as much anymore. And I just think the inevitability of Atraxa is way better. And it's also got some tournament chops too, which is wild. Like it's 26% conversion rate, has won Chaos Treasure Series 2. So like, it's got a bunch of top four, or it's got a couple top fours, several top 16s. Like, this is a deck that I think is better than most people would think it is, and is in the best, like, one. It's in a four color, you know, block, right? Like, four colors and up, your deck can only be so bad, right? So I really like Atraxa.
I say that, and I was agreeing with you, four colors and up, your deck can only be so bad. And then I was thinking to myself, I have seen some pretty weird ones. So, but yeah, you know, if we're talking stuff that is likely to go to a tournament, yes.
I mean, as a food chain deck, I like this significantly more than I like First Sliver too. Because, like,
I mean, I'm with you on that, but I actually just think First Sliver is one of the worst food chain decks.
I think Tyler, it's so good to see somebody who agrees with me on this. Everybody's like, but it has red. And I'm like, I don't think red adds that much to the food chain plan, guys. I know you get squee, but I don't think it's that impactful. Like,
I think your commander being nothing but one of the combo pieces in the command zone and offering you no other value or incentives is really weak and doesn't quite cut it.
And then Atraxa is just like, here are 10 cards. Figure it out.
Yeah.
And also, I'm going to pressure the table's life totals really fast. So it is my number 5. Looking at number 4, what is your number 4, Tyler?
Number 4 is where I have Dawnwaker.
Okay. Thrasios Bruce. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on Thras Bruce?
I'm a big fan of this deck. I think it makes great use of the card advantage access, but also the ability to pressure life totals in later game. And it has a lot of combo lines that don't ask you to run, you know, bad creatures or bad pieces. So that's really appealing. I think it's really resilient because of those same factors, because it's so capable of grinding while also being able to kind of pivot and try and pull a tutor and go for the win immediately when the time is right. If you can suss out that the table's there, or if you get down your abolisher or your your silence effects for your own turn. So right. I think it's just able to win at a lot of different times in the game and hang with other decks at a lot of different times in the game, which makes it one of those decks that's really good into a blind meta because it can deal with a lot of different kinds of pods.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I have this in my notes for Thrass Bruce, but it's what Thrasios Timna wishes it was. is kind of how I feel about it. Like the way Thrass Timna decks play these days is it just every time I look at them, I'm like, why is this just not Dawnwaker? I feel like it feels like they either want to be like slightly worse Dawnwaker or slightly worse Timna Krom. And so that's where I'm like, I just think I would either do one or the other if I was playing Thrass Timna. But yeah, I don't have Thrass Bruce at four. At four, I have Najeela the Blade Blossom.
Oh, sure. I don't have Najeela the Blade Blossom at four.
Okay. So for me, Najeela's at four. And my exact note was, I think it should be much higher on the list. But I think it suffers from the fact that everybody kind of thinks it's like either the best deck or the second best deck and kind of gets focused down because of that. My experience playing Najeela in tournaments has been, if I can't win fast enough, then I'm going or get an advantage engine out fast enough to deal with the fact that I'm being kind of targeted, then I'm not going to be able to deal with the actual problem at the table. The other issue though, is you are the actual problem at the table 90% of the time anyway. Because Najeela does have that huge inevitability thing to it, where it's just it doesn't need Derevi or Treasure or the rogue that makes treasures. Grim Hireling.
You mean the Grim Hireling?
Yeah. It doesn't need that. It doesn't need Nature's Will or Druid's Repository, any of those cards. It will just eventually win on its own.
Just that one 3-mana card.
That in and of itself will just win the game. So that is why I have it in the top five. Current tournament versions for me are a little bit, I think they're trading mid-range pieces for turbo and speed. And so I think that is kind of goes back to what I was saying about Rog'Sai, where I think when you are giving up commander advantage in the, card advantage in the command zone, I do think you do need to have some sort of grind engines in your decks. And I think going so hard into the turbo plans may not be exactly the best way for it, but I don't think these decks are maybe 5 to 10 cards different from Pongo's version of the deck. So they're not all vastly different. They're all very similar. But I mean, hell, my version of the deck was a pod deck. So you can build it in a lot of different ways.
I think that's one of the really appealing things about it as a commander, and the ones that offer you that kind of flexibility, it's easier for me to kind of push them higher up in the top 10, in part because there's multiple versions of the deck that are good, and they really, they can hang for a lot of different players with different play styles. It gives you a reasonable amount of tuning agency, which I like a lot.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that there. Moving up the list here, number three. What do you have here at three?
Najeela. We just talked about it. That is where Najeela is number three. Yep.
Najeela at number three. I definitely don't. No notes. My top four were kind of hard for me because I was like, I know me what too. My number one is, and I know what my number five is, and 2, 3, and 4. I really had to think pretty hard about it. But number three is where I have Dawnwaker. I have Thrass Bruce there at number three.
That we just had those flip-flopped.
Just had them flip-flopped. It is not bothered by the lack of black at all. And I think it might be the best deck in the format after turn three.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty good case for that. As a good deck after turn three player, I see that at the table and I'm like, shit, I'm not the only one who wins if we go along.
It is one of those decks where it's like every game that I've ever seen just get you see the game start to go along and Thras Bruce is at the table and you're like, fuck, I can't deal with this. So I love that we were like almost in sync there at number three and four. Number two, what do you have here at number two, Tyler?
Number two is where I have Winota.
Okay.
I imagine, I don't even know if Winota's in your top 10 or if you're going to, I have a hard time imagining you would rate it higher than I did, but it is a deck that I fear and respect tremendously. And I think I'm being biased a lot because of the decks that I play most, especially Kinnan, where it's doing a very similar thing, but doing it faster and in a way that my deck cannot cope with.
Yep.
So that terrifies me. I think I also just play against it very, very often. So I see a ton of it. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead. Say your thing, man.
All I was going to say was I think it is incredibly consistent for a deck that is in theory high variance. Mm-hmm. And it is just unreasonable that a Boros deck is capable is capable of that amount of speed. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Without tutors, basically. Not quite, but almost without tutors.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you're just like attacking and then seeing 21 cards, who needs tutors, right? Like
yeah,
you just saw exactly. A third of your deck. I actually don't have Winota on my list, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Winota was one of the cards that are one of the decks where I'm like, it's kind of been teched out, I feel like, of the tournament scene a little bit, where people have started running a lot of Containment Priests, people have started running more Grafdigger's Cages, and I am seeing that be more... I am seeing Winota either get disrupted or just, like, targeted down. And I think Ian can, like, contest to that, where it's, like, anytime a Winota deck, like, sits down, there people just, like, freak out and then don't let you do a thing. So that's my only knock on it. I originally had it in my top five, and then I kept, like, not... It was kind of the same thing with Kinnan, where I just kept moving it down, moving it down, and then... My number two is actually Tivit, Seller of Secrets.
Nice.
I think Tivit is maybe... First of all, it's the best Displacer Kitten deck in the format. If you didn't see that, was it that?
If I didn't intuit that
foreshadowing earlier, it is surprisingly capable of matching the speed of tables, even though it has that big fat commander. Like it can just be like, all right, this is a Thassa's Oracle Demonic Consultation game. Let's go, and it's really able to hit you from like every angle where, okay, so you shut off my artifacts. I'm just going to hit you in the face with a Sphinx. So you've taken away you've put a Draenith out. That's fine. I'm just going to play the best cards in the game. Like you have all of these things where it just kind of hits you every single angle. And it always just seems to be like, this might be, again, some recency bias where Jamaican Dude just won a treasure series over the weekend with it last weekend. I just build it and have been incredibly impressed by the performance of it. It might be a little bit of recency bias on it, but I think like if you want a deck that can, if you like playing the type of decks that I like playing, which are the like control mid-range type decks, Tivit is like perfect because it sits there, it hits you from a different angle than what most decks are used to playing on, and then it also can just win the game because it's also in blue black. Like it is, I have I remember seeing this deck and we were talking about it on our set review, and I was like, it's fine. It'll be whatever. I think it's a little too expensive. And then I started seeing it out in the wild and I was like, okay, I'm wrong. And then I kept seeing it do well and well and well and well and well. And then I was like, oh, I'm very wrong about this. As far as like results go, it has of the decks with more than 50 entries on EDH top 16, the best conversion rate.
Oh, wow.
Of, and it's a 28.57% conversion rate. It is quite good. And I think the only reason it doesn't have more like top 16 numbers than like maybe a Najeela or a Krom is because those like Najeela has double the entries, Krom has triple the entries. So like I think that's the only thing that's separating them from a like statistical standpoint there. I look at it and I'm just like, man, every time I see this deck enter a tournament, it's excellent. And
I want to keep this in mind when we hit number one, because I think it's going to be relevant. I want to come back to that statistics thing, but let's talk about it. What do you have at number one? I think I know.
I think we're both. I think we're in sync on this one. What's your number one, Tyler?
Yeah, it is Tim Nokrom.
Oh wow! Surprise me too.
That is so crazy.
That's wild.
Oh my god! I didn't even think it would be on your list.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I hate any, you know, ad nauseum decks, right? You know, so right. It would never be on my list, and I'm incapable of giving objective opinions.
So let's talk about the statistics thing with this real quick. Where we just had that conversation. Here's because you were saying it has a surprisingly low win conversion rate on top 16.
Yeah.
So I want to posit a theory. I'm totally just guessing. This is a hunch, but
yeah,
I think this and to a lesser extent maybe Najeela and other decks that feel like really accessible entry points for players who say I just want to play the best deck. Mm-hmm. I think it invites a lot of people to pick this deck up if they've, you know, maybe only played it a couple times, aren't super familiar with it, because it's what they think they need to take to a tournament instead of a pet deck. And I think, as we said sort of at the top in our introduction, there's so much about understanding what your deck needs to do in a particular pod composition and how that informs your mulligan decisions and how you as a pilot play that has a much, much bigger impact than the deck you're playing. That I think, you know, because these decks end up being kind of the like, oh, well, this is what I should take if I want to win choice for people who don't play them. I think it might dilute their actual conversion numbers for experienced pilots who really know what they want to do with the deck.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that, where I think that like, so there's definitely like, so 157 entries on here. You can vary like, and it's notably higher than the Najeela with 95, right? Like, and then Tivit with 56. Like, it is a notably higher amount of conversion or of entries than like anything else. And I definitely agree with you on that. I also think it's just like the hotness and what everybody's like, you know, it. Because one of the things that's interesting, because especially when you look at like a thing like EDH Top 16 or MTG Goldfish, when they sort things by their entries or how much they are popping up in tournaments, it creates the perception of this is the best deck, not the this is the most played deck, right? And I do think it is both of those things. But I do think that, so one of the reasons why I don't think this is a great entry point commander for people and why I would rather start somebody on Najeela is Tim Nokrom has a lot of nuance to it that Najeela doesn't. Najeela does have its nuances, but it also has the, hey, if you just keep attacking with your commander, you're going to eventually win the game plan, right? Like Tim Nokrom doesn't really have that. And it's, there was a pro player in Minneapolis. I forget who it was, but was playing Magic with with Reed and Morgan and some folks late at night. And he described Thras Krom, or not Thras, Timna Krom as a control deck. And like, I think that's a very apt way of describing it, because it's probably like, I don't know that it's a very true control deck, but it plays a lot of interaction. It is very like able to map it. Like, it definitely does well in longer games. But it's also able to match the pace of the table. But it also plays just like a ton. I mean, it's just literally like four color control. And then what's your win condition? Oh, I just beat you with Underworld Breach. Like, you could probably make a case that you could cut Ad Nauseam from Brian Koval's list and the deck would not suffer in the least. Like,
yeah, I think the deck barely needs Ad Nauseam. It allows it to go for faster wins for sure. But you make a great point, and I love that you bring up applying the term control deck to it, because I absolutely agree. As we mentioned before, I think fighting on the axis of cards in hand and a ton of unknown information and mm-hmm. really not telegraphing wins at all is such a strength of this deck.
Yep.
And when it's in the role of control, which it very often is, it feels like it's the police of the table. You don't even know when it's going for a win. You know what I mean? Yep. It's a very hard deck to read and to understand what position that player is in at any given time, because it just does not give away much information, which is a great place to be in all stages of the game.
And it's interesting because I always see people who are new to it play it like it's a Turbo Nos deck. And
right.
Like, and that's kind of where I want to step in. And just, I've been saying this for 2 years now, is Blue Farm. We're kind of moving away from that name finally. But Timna Krom is not a Turbo Nos deck. If you want to play a Turbo Nos deck, play Rog'Sai. Because that is actually a turbo deck. This deck,
if you want to play a Turbo Nos deck that's actually fun, play Dargo Ikro. But
yes. but like, it's one of those things where when you look at it, it's like, oh, well, it has the tools to go fast. Yes, that's because it's capable of going fast. That doesn't mean that's where it's best at, right?
Is it time for another sports analogy?
I was going to do a car analogy to try and meet you in the middle on this one.
Okay. Yeah.
So like, imagine we've got like a couple, we've got a McLaren M1 or something like that, you know, or we've got some of these really nice sports cars out here that are really good at handling twists and turns. And you put it next to this tricked out muscle car that is built to just go in a straight line. If you put those two on a drag strip next to each other, depending on which luxury sports car you pick, the muscle car is probably likely to win in that scenario, because a lot of them are designed in ways to have torque that you can't even begin to imagine, right? So they just zip off and go. Then you put them on to a road course with twists and turns and all of those sorts of things. And then you'll start to see where on the corners, the McLaren kind of handles a little bit better, even though it's fast and pushes you to the side and you feel like your guts are falling out. One of my favorite things with the McLaren is the video of Jeremy Clarkson reviewing it on Top Gear, of him just being like freaking out in that car as it's just like going around a corner handling perfectly, but he's just like,
I'm gonna need to see
we're going so fast. It's beautiful. but like, you get onto a straightaway, yeah, the muscle car is going to start catching up a little bit. But then you start hitting the corners, and your sports car with the design tuned handling, all of that stuff, is going to outmaneuver that. And so basically what I'm getting here is, if you want to go in a straight line, this is not the deck for you. It will be able to go in a straight line faster than a lot of other cars, but it's not the best at doing that. So if you're wanting to do that, pick the best at doing that, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, if you want to go in a straight line, you need to stick to a deck like Kanan that has a very clear game plan that doesn't change a lot, or you need to go on a deck like a real Turbonaut deck that is just going to try and do the thing very fast. I am 100% with you that this is all about nuance and being able to be extremely reactive and figure out how you're going to win by outplaying your opponents and outvaluing them and making sure that you shut down and interact with them at exactly the right points. And that definitely takes a very different mentality and approach to every pod than trying to treat it as a normal quote unquote ad nauseum deck.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you so deeply on that. And I'm glad that we're in unison there. Still definitely the best deck. If you're a new player, try Winota, try Najeela, try something that is maybe not as nuanced as Timnacrom, because unless you're like a really, you know, experienced pilot, it's just one of those things where it's like the addition of two extra opponents is already a lot of new variables to deal with for players who are new to the format. Don't also give yourself a deck that is like that needs a lot of nuance on top of that if you're new to the format. Like,
and I think it's not like, oh, you can't handle the nuance. It's like, a lot of the nuances are because you need a very detailed understanding of the meta and what different decks are trying to do, how they win, what they need to achieve at different phases of the game in order to interact most effectively with them and get the best bang for your buck, get the most, you know, 3-for-1s with spells that you can, where you shut something down after opponents have already committed multiple cards to a play line.
Yeah.
And you just can't do that if you don't know the meta, play against a variety of decks a lot of the time. It is is just too hard to get that experience.
Yeah, you got to just play a bunch of CEDH, and it's easier to learn the nuances with CEDH when you are playing a deck that has a very like simple A to B game plan, and that's where you will learn all of those nuances. And then you can go and like start playing crap like Tivit and Timnacrom and all Thrass Bruce and all the decks that ask you to be, you know, knowledgeable and all of that. But any final thoughts for you on this? This is kind of I might be making this a series where I at the, you know, towards the end of every month might start looking at like, what do we think the meta's at? So I think, what is your thoughts overall on the meta and where things are at?
I think the first thing I would say is relative to Eternal formats in general, I think CEDH is in an unbelievably healthy place. If, you know, neither you nor I can agree on what the top 10 decks even are. Right. And I think we both could easily name, you know, another 15 decks on top of that we think are capable of hanging with these decks and performing similarly. Like, it is a broad meta, you know, and I think people on the outside looking into CDH only see, oh, so many games end in Thoracle or something like that, without really understanding that, you know, it's about the journey, not the destination. And just because you're going to win with Thoracle, it doesn't mean that you have to play only one style of deck. I think we have a really great variety, and doing this was just a great exercise and reminder that we're in a really healthy place right now in this meta, and I'm loving it.
I would agree with you on that. I definitely think it's a wide open meta. I still would not mind a Dockside ban, but that's its own. Yeah, it that just kind of feels like a broader EDH issue at this point. But like in general, I think the format is in a really good spot, and especially, it feels like it's finally out of its, like, I was thinking of how to describe like the place where CEDH is at right now, where when, you know, after Flash got banned, it felt like we were getting like CEDH was getting out of this really long-term relationship and was kind of, you know, hopping around, figuring out exactly what it was. And now it feels like it's time to like put on our big boy pants, get over it, and then, you know, go, you know, grow up a little bit. And I feel like we have been doing that. And as far as like a meta goes, where the meta doesn't feel like it's just like one specific thing. It's, like you said, very wide open, a lot of options available, and it doesn't feel like it's, like, I would say like maybe a year or two ago, I felt like it was just a NAS world at that point. Now I feel like, especially as stuff has come out, it feels like you don't need to have NAS. You don't need to have Thassa's Oracle even. There are so many things that you can play. You can play a mono black deck and have great success. And I think that's really cool for our format, because I don't think we could have said that 2 to 3 years ago. So.
And I don't think you can say it about almost any other format either at the moment.
like no other format is this wide open with this many options. So. But
awesome.
Well, hey, Tyler, thank you so much for joining us. For the people who don't know who Play to Win is, tell us a little bit about Play to Win and what you guys do over there.
Sure thing. So we are a CEDH exclusive channel, almost, occasionally a tiny bit of Modern, occasionally a little bit of other stuff, but primarily we do CEDH gameplay, talk about CEDH topics in a weekly podcast, do a couple shorts, all that kind of thing. We go to a ton of events, so come see us. We have a ton of merch, including we have Gay to Win apparel through the end of Pride Month that I'm really excited about. You can find that stuff on Bonfire or check out our other merch at playtowinmtg.com.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for having me. It is always a pleasure to chat with you in particular. And I love the work you do with Mind Sculptors.
I love the work y'all do. You guys are the salt of the earth. My favorite people to see at events. And I was very glad that you were able to hop on this podcast with me today and cause a little bit of discourse on the internet.
Absolutely. I cannot wait for how many people are going to tell me, like, Winona's not number two.
I'm excited for people to go at my list, because I know my list is definitely took some shots, but that's fine. It's me being a hot take express is so not normal. well, with that being said, thank you all for joining us today. I do want to give a little bit of a forewarning. Next week is our 100th episode, which is fucking wild that we have 100 episodes now. So stay tuned for that. I am moving during the month of June, so there is, the podcast might not be as regular, but I'm still going to try to get it out as, you know, regularly as I can. We will be doing our Lord of the Rings set review on the 26th, so keep an eye out for that. And outside of that, speaking of things that you can do to help support the channel, you brought up your merch. We have our Could Be a Najeela card shirt that you can pick up at our store at themindsculptors.com/shop. You can also go to Patreon to support us over there at patreon.com/themindsculptors. And also make sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. That really helps out the algorithm. Please leave a comment down there. Do all the things, like, subscribe, everything, no matter what platform you're on. Greatly appreciate it. Helps keep the lights on around here. And greatly appreciate everybody. Thank you all for 99 episodes is wild to me.
That is awesome.
That is, it is so wild to me that I started this like 2.5 years ago as just like a side hobby, and now it's my job. And thank you so much to everybody who has supported me and enjoyed what we do. And it is the biggest honor of my life to get to do this every week. So with that being said, thank you all for joining us. And from all of us here at the Mind Sculptors, I'm Callahan, and we'll see you next time.